Mental Health Monday
on Radio City Talk
with Mick Coyle.
Tackling the stigma.
Radio City Talk.
Welcome to Mental Health Monday. My name is Mick Coyle. I do hope you're well. This time of the year, the show gets sort of disrupted slightly by the bank holiday. So we're with you this week. There'll be a break next week and we're back the week after that. Our conversations, though, continue focusing on mental health and how people are feeling. The focus of today's show is going to be about how you feel in yourself in regard to your career. It's going to be a really interesting conversation, this one, with our guest today, because, of course, we define ourselves so much now on what we do for a living. How often do you talk to, catch up with friends? What are you doing now? And we mean, what is the job? Not, are you happy? Have you got kids? You know, what's the family situation? Do you still see X, Y, or Z? We talk about people and we judge people, don't we, about your career. But how do you judge yourself as well? Paul Cope is an author, and he is the author of a book called The 7 Secrets to Change Your Career. And he's our guest this week on Mental Health Monday. Paul, great to see you. Thank you for your time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Hey, you're an author.
I am.
A writer. Is that a career? Are you started doing that now, or do you reassess how you think about the word career now?
Well, lots of answers to that question. Yes, is the answer. Mainly is reassess constantly, which I think we all should do, actually. My mates often joke that they can't keep track because now I'm an author. So my LinkedIn update changes every like three, four months. But yeah, I really enjoyed writing the book, actually. So I think being an author is something I'll be doing regularly going forward. But it's a complete change from what I did in the past.
We're going to talk about sort of your story and how you got up to the point where you are now, and the fact you've got the knowledge to put this stuff down onto a piece of paper and then to offer that advice to other people. That idea of people defining themselves by a career, or coming up with a career and thinking, well, that's the goal, I've decided. You were absolutely guilty of this, weren't you? You picked a career without even really knowing what the career was, what it would entail, or whether or not it would actually make you happy.
Yeah, I was textbook. So I was, for people who don't know the story, I was a lawyer, basically. I was going to be a lawyer from before I can remember ever knowing anything, basically. I just grew up with this story that I was going to be a lawyer. And my whole life, there was no doubt in my mind. Like, going through school, I was one of those kids who, when you said, what are you going to be when you grow up? I said, I'm going to be a solicitor. And I always remember, actually, people being jealous of it. It was one of those things where I was like, oh, I wish I knew what I wanted to be. And I was like, yeah. I was probably quite proud of myself for it at the time. And it wasn't until I got to the middle of a law degree and in the middle of university where I was like, oh, I don't know why I want to do this.
It's funny, isn't it? But we do this in life, don't we? Where we pick something, or we think we pick something that we think we want, and then we go down a route. You talk in the book about the fact I think at the age of 32, you'd set up your own law firm. Even though along the line, you'd had all these things going, hang on a minute. But then you were in a rut, or that was a pathway, yeah. And you just carried on ploughing on through it.
Yeah. So I mean, I realised when I was 19 that I didn't really want to be a lawyer in the middle of a law degree, and had a conversation with an uncle where one of my favourite uncles, we get on really well and really trust his judgment, and he basically sat me down in a pub in Anfield and said, well, nobody likes their job, son. So What would you want to be if you could be anything? And I was like, I'd be a footballer. And by then, I'd already had a cruciate knee ligaments operation and was never in a million years going to play for Liverpool. And he was like, well, you should just do a job that makes you loads of money then. And I remember at 19 thinking, that makes loads of sense. I looked around and thought, well, no one likes the job. One of my mate's dad said to me, actually, around that same time, if it was meant to be called work, if it was meant to be fun, they wouldn't call it work. It's not meant to be fun. It's meant to be this thing. And I think the generations that have gone before us have all thought that it's like that's what it is. So yeah, once I'd gone down that path, I talk in the book about something called the sunk cost fallacy, which I think is a bit of a scourge on humanity in the Western world, is that once we've invested so much in something, we feel like we should carry on doing it until it bears fruit. And I was guilty of that for a decade at least.
It's interesting that because sunk cost can play into work, it can play into relationships, yeah, and all kinds of different things. That thing of, though, older generations poisoning the well a little bit,
yeah, yeah,
is an interesting one, isn't it? You know, because it sounds like it's good advice, or it's somebody being pragmatic with their advice in the conversation they're having at the time. But that thing of going, well, you're not supposed to enjoy work. Well, you don't want to say, well, you're not supposed to really enjoy life. Yeah. Or, well, it's hard, isn't it? So, and it's supposed to be hard. And that's how you know you're doing it right. Yeah. That might be their lived experience of it as well. But it's actually pretty poor advice, isn't it?
Yeah, it's pretty bleak as well when you think about it. This is something I've come to terms with now. It's not even their fault. We can only all give advice if we're asked for it based on our own experience. And this goes back generations. This isn't just the generation above me and you and their grandparents. It goes back and back and back, and everyone just knows what they know. So I think we're in a world now where that attitude is shifting slightly, and part of the reason I wrote the book is I want to be part of that shift, where the number of people I chat to now, friends and family, my own peers, who still have that attitude that, well, it's just your job, isn't it? That's just the way it is, isn't it? I don't know. I just think it's nonsense.
There's a question that sometimes people ask when they go, oh, it's my birthday. How old are you? How old do you think I am?
Yeah.
And maybe this was a sign, because sometimes, you know, if you're dealing with something internally, externally, it starts to show. But as a 32-year-old running their own law firm, hey, Paulie's doing all right. He's got his own law firm. He must be doing okay for himself. What sort of responses were you getting?
Oh, it was hilarious, because I actually set it up when I was 29, and I found a photo the other day. I've always looked younger than I am. So I used to, that question I always used to get, people sort of guessing 5, sometimes 10 years younger than I actually was. So when I was 29, people would easily be guessing 23, 24. I was quite smug about it. By the time I was 32 and I'd been running a law firm for 3 years, I was getting 40, you know, 40 guesses of 40. And I remember thinking at the time, God, that is not a good sign, is it? And that was just sleepless nights, ridiculous hours in work, bad diet, people who end up in that cycle, it's the same pattern. You don't eat well, you start drinking heavily because you're getting from work every day and you think, oh, I need a glass of wine, I need a JD, I need a beer. Slippery slope.
In terms of yourself and your view of a career, were you very much of a mindset that actually your career would define who you were as a person, that you would define yourself by the job that you had?
Yeah, it did. Well, it did, and it had from when I was 2, 3 years old. It was defining the whole thing. It was rolled out at family parties and put, you know what it's like in families. And again, it's nobody's fault. This is just the pattern of our family systems that it is. Everyone's proud of the kids who are doing well, and they hold them up as the... I was the golden boy, really, in our family. I've got one older cousin who'd been to university, but he was in Australia. So I was the first in Liverpool to go to university, and everyone was so proud. So my whole identity was linked to being a lawyer, which is part of the reason it was so difficult to break away from.
With that, and that gets down to the cost that you put into that. Mm. At what point was the first moment where you started to think, not only maybe I picked the wrong thing, but actually this is starting to have a negative impact on me, and this might actually be causing me problems far beyond the career choice that I've made?
It was, do you know what, looking back, it probably wasn't while, because I was working for big international law firms before I set up my own. So I'd probably done that for sort of 3-4 years, trainee solicitor and then qualified. And then when I set up the firm to begin with, it was great. It was really exciting. There was loads of buzz about it, starting from scratch and building. It was sort of the typical fairy tale story of starting in your bedroom and people not knowing that, and building up just with a phone and a blank piece of paper and getting these clients and opening a city centre office. But it probably took maybe 2 years into it, 18 months, 2 years into it, where the pressure starts to tail and started taking on employees. And anyone, I work with businesses now to help them break free of this sort of stuff, and business owners, because anyone who's experienced that knows how difficult it is when it's hard to describe to people who've never done it. That I often think that the world's split into people who've run businesses and employed others and people who haven't, because you just can't explain it to people. I'd be lying there sort of on a Wednesday night, couldn't sleep, 3 o'clock in the morning, thinking, I've got to pay wages on Friday. Where's that money coming from? And it's the pressure of being almost feeling responsible for other people's lives and livelihoods and mortgages and kids is just something, until you've experienced it, I don't think you can ever understand.
Was that the start of a depressive period that you had there?
Yeah, I would say looking back, probably 2 years into it, that was the sort of spell when I was, and at the time, again, it just felt like, because of the type of personality I am, I'm sort of you have been in the past, the classic, A1 driven alpha male type. So it wasn't even, at the time, I wouldn't have said, oh, I'm suffering here. It was just, I need to find ways to make sure I can still function. And so it was like getting up at, I wouldn't sleep at night, maybe 1-2 hours sleep, and then be up at 7 and listening to high energy music at 7 o'clock in the morning to get myself pumped up for the day. And so, yeah, that was the, I think that was the sort of the first seeds of mental suffering, really, issues and just not knowing quite what was wrong and how to deal with it.
It's interesting that, because of course people might think, well, actually you can understand the suffering there because there was the pressures that you're putting on yourself. But for so many people, there's a consideration that that pressure is normal. Well, of course, I will feel like that because I'm running my own business, and I will feel like this because I do have, you know, people's expectations about payments and mortgages and staff to think of and look after. Was there a moment where you thought this is actually making me feel ill? This is making me mentally not very well at all.
Yeah, and well, definitely mentally, but also physically. I started getting physical symptoms, and actually, after I'd published the book, I realized there was a big story I didn't even put in, which I'd mentioned to a couple of mates at the time where. I had for weeks and weeks, I had a sort of numbness in my left arm. I remember mentioning it to friends walking up to the match. And you know what lads are like? We don't talk about this stuff, generally speaking. And so when you do mention it, and usually lads are very good at taking the mick out of each other, when lads show concern, you know there's something wrong. And I remember phoning sort of the health line, whatever it was, the alternative to 999. And the woman on the other end of the phone saying, I'm sending an ambulance for your son. It was, I always think it was like speaking to an auntie. And she's like, you need to put the phone down and come to hospital. And that was the moment when I was like, oh, this is getting out of hand now. And that was sort of physical manifestations of mental issues.
Was there a point during that the word failure or fail, was that coming into your mind that if you did stop, or if you stepped off that treadmill, or if you held up your hands and said, whoa, let's just all calm down a little bit, that there would be a sense that failure, or you had failed?
Yeah, not. I'm pretty good at sort of looking at the upsides of things and the successes and how even when things go wrong, you can take good stuff out of them. More than anything else, it was about letting people down. It was looking at friends and family and my wife at the time and thinking, I can't stop because of what they think about things and how they feel about things and what impact will it have on them. And it not being even there was a long period of time where it wouldn't even be a consideration to stop. It was well, we're stuck in this. I always talk about building a prison around yourself. It's like, and I remember lying there one night thinking, I've built this prison around me and I just have, that's it. It's the old, I love old cliches and people say, oh, that's an old cliche. And I say, well, they stick around for a reason. It's you've made your bed, now lie in it. And there was that internal sort of monologue of, yeah, well, this is what you've chosen. This is what you've done. Your friends and, well, more so your family are very proud and this is their story. You've got to stick with it now.
But it's so interesting that, isn't it? Because I think loads of people will relate to that aspect of the story, Paul, that you built the, quote, the prison around you. And prisons can be mortgages and houses that you can't sell in areas you don't want to live and all kinds of different things. But every single step along the way, I guess you made for what you thought were the right reasons, that you thought, that's a good job. I'll get paid well for that. I can support a family with that one. My family will be proud. I can have my Saturdays off and I can still go to the game. That every single decision that you are making, on the face of it, has got a positive spin. And then there comes a point X number of years later, you look back and you think, well, every single one of those decisions has just taken me further up a path, which I've now got to either make a decision on turning round, coming back out the other way, then and that upsets every single person coming back out the other side. But so many decisions we make in life, whether it's picking partners, houses, type of cars, you make them all with the absolute most positive of intentions. They don't always have the most positive effects on your existence.
Yeah. Absolutely. I think that's one of the most difficult things to reconcile. I love, because I'm a big football fan, I love making football analogies, and there's always a football analogy you can make. And I remember hearing Rick Parry talking about when they sold to Hicks and Gillette, and he got asked, does he regret it? And he said, when people ask me that question, what they mean is, do I regret it with the information I've got now? But that's not a fair question to ask me. All I can ask myself is, would I have made the same decision with the same facts in the same position again? The stuff you find out afterwards, well, that's just life. That's the way it happens. And I think it's a really good example, because whenever we all make these decisions, as you say, you're making them based on the information you've got at the time. And a lot of the times what I've learned now is the information you've got and the sort of psychology behind it and the emotions behind it are quite flawed. But when you don't know that, well, you're just left with what you've got to do. So when I look back, I actually don't regret anything that happened. All of the decisions were made, as you say, for the right reasons at the time, and I've learned a lot from them. It's been a hell of a journey, and Would I go in? Same question for Rick Parry. I wouldn't make any of those decisions differently. I'd make them differently now, but I'm a different person now. I've got different experience.
Is there a danger that people will go and look to you and think, this guy is going to solve all my problems? Because there are people out there who portray themselves as being sort of like a Jesus-like figure, and they go and speak in these big conference halls and charge people about 75 quid a ticket to come in, and they've got a secret to life that only they know, but they're going to teach you, and that's going to solve all of your problems if we all stand up. And it becomes almost like a religious thing. You've not gone down that route, it's probably fair to say.
No, well, do you know what? It's really funny, because even from a marketing perspective, when you start learning about this industry and this profession, there's so much, it's just all of those things you've mentioned, the marketing techniques and tricks. And one of the things I thought was, even from a marketing perspective, it's better to not be like those people, because you stand out from the crowd then. And I make a point of saying this in the book, and all my favourite people in the self-help personal development type industries all say a similar thing, which is, listen to this story. Here's the stuff I've done. Take the bitch that work for you and ignore the rest. Because something I don't like about the personal development industry is that sort of the sales pitch that there's magic bullets. And if you do these steps, then you'll be fine. And I just don't believe that. We're all different. Everyone's got their own individual sort of circumstances and situations. And there's lots of things that we have in common, and there's lots of processes you can go through and thinking patterns that can help. But ultimately, yeah, this is my story, and it's about what I did, and it will resonate and already has resonated with a lot of people. But I'm sure there's some people who it won't resonate with at all, and that's the point. You should listen to the bits that do work for you and discard the rest.
And I think you say right at the introduction of the book that you're as cynical as other people are about this, and actually if you're expecting that, this isn't the book for you.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I've been to loads of these. I've followed all these people on social media and been to those types of events you've talked about. And I mean, I go in very much with a cynical head on and think, okay, what can I get out of this? But what bits do I need to be wary of? Because ultimately, a lot of the time, people are just trying to sell you stuff. That's the reality.
I think sometimes, though, I think sometimes it's the same with politicians, that they can say things and you go, I agree with that, I agree with that. As soon as they say something which you completely disagree with, you suddenly go, hang on a minute. Well, maybe I didn't agree with all the other stuff.
Yeah.
And actually that thing of my word is gospel, it becomes quite a false thing, because then they say something or do something that you disagree with, or they come up with a line which, you know, completely goes against something you believe in. And you suddenly think, hang on a minute. Well, if they think that, then why should I believe anything else? Yeah. They've said. Whereas if it's coming from the first hand, it's going, well, that was the lived experience. That's what he went through. That's what she went through. Therefore, I can either learn from that, I can learn from their mistakes, or I can just dismiss that and think it's not particularly relevant to my story. What have people said to you, Paul, about bits in the book where they've gone, that bit where you said about really stuck with me, or the thing that really stood out to me was the bit where, has there been one or two standout things that have really resonated with people?
That's been really fascinating, actually, because there's been loads of really small bits through the book that have hit different people in different ways. But the first chapter of the book is just my story, and that has resonated with so many people. It's been frightening, but also overwhelming, the number of people, because I put my email address in the book as well, so people can get in touch with me, because the whole point of this is I want to help as many people as I can. And when I wrote it, it was like, if I can help one person from my experience, then fantastic. And I've already had more of an impact than that, which is nice. But people just email me with their life stories and saying how, one lady emailed me and said, my story was so similar to her story that if she'd have, she had an electronic copy. She said, if I'd have had a hard copy, I'd have been like Joey and Friends and put it in the freezer, because it was frightening how similar it was. And it's something I've learned through this process and I mentioned this towards the end of the book, especially when you're suffering from depression or mental health issues, you feel isolated and you feel like you're all alone. And something that has massively come out of this for me is pretty much everyone's got a similar story. So the number of people who have said to me, yeah, if you just take your story and switch lawyer for dentist, it's me. You've just told my story, basically, which is, it has been overwhelming to get some of the stories back.
I guess the sort of the key question in all of this is, when you make changes to your career and through that your life as well, mm-hmm. you've made all the decisions that got to the to that point in by making supposedly positive decisions, albeit, you know, maybe a little bit misplaced. But then you want to make another positive decision, and that positive decision is to make yourself happy by coming up with a different solution, a different pathway. And on the face of it, you'd go, well, I'm not happy doing this anymore, so I'm going to do something else. And you would think, well, that should be an easy decision to make because it's a positive one, isn't it? It's going to be better for me. Things are going to be... It's like climate change. Like, if we change the way we look at the environment, we'll have more green jobs, they'll be sustainable, the air will be cleaner, the seas won't... We're not going to die in however many years. Mm-hmm. They're all... And yet we still can't make that decision because it feels as if the rut that we're in is impossible to escape. So what does it feel like, Paul, when you make that decision and you go, right, things are going to change? Is it really difficult? Is it too difficult to make that change? Does it get easier? Or do you suddenly get a moment where you go, boom, I'm so glad I made that choice. I feel so much better already.
I think it's a perfect example of it's different for everybody. There did come a moment for me where it was like, boom, I know what I've got to do now. The prison example, I remember vividly lying in bed one night, again, sleepless night. I had insomnia for probably 10 years. And I was lying there one night and thought, well, if I built this prison, I can take the prison down. I've got the blueprint. I know how to do that. And then I can build something else in its place, and then started to go through. So that was sort of my epiphany moment. But then it's a step-by-step process to take the prison down and to rebuild it. And going back to the sort of the personal development industry, I think there are too many people out there who sort of sell the magic bullet and say, oh, well, you'll change it overnight. And something I'm keen to say to people is, you probably won't. I'm sure some people do, and there are examples out there of people who do. But for me, it was a step-by-step process, and it took years. I sold my law firm in 2015, we're coming up to the fourth anniversary. And it was only in the middle of last year I really started to feel like, yeah, I'm getting on back on top of things here. I feel good. My new path for the way I make money is better. So that took 3 years of gentle making decisions, making mistakes. And one of the things that for people to bear in mind is they're tough decisions to make. I probably the biggest chapter in the book actually is talking about the psychology and emotion behind why we don't make the decision. And even the idea that you say about figuring out what you want to do next is the easy bit. To most people I meet, it's the opposite of that. It's one of the reasons they stay in the thing that makes them unhappy is they've got no idea what they do otherwise.
Well, it's that thing, isn't it, of long term, do you want to be happy? Do you want to do something different? You go, yeah, absolutely, I want to be happy, I want to do something different. Are you prepared to make those changes today? You kind of go, not really today, thanks. You know, it becomes, so your long-term goals are completely at odds with what you're either capable of or intending to do on any given day. So is today the day you're going to make all those changes that are going to make you happy? No, it's not today, actually. And then why is it not today?
Yeah, well, I could talk all day just on this one topic. The psychology behind that is fascinating. And I've heard there's loads of different things spring to mind. One of the things is when people talk about giving up smoking, and you say you've got to give up for the rest of your life. And I heard someone say a while ago, yeah, but you don't need to give up for the rest of your life today. All you need to do is not smoke today.
I heard David Mitchell, the comedian, being interviewed, and he wears glasses, and they said, do you ever fancy getting laser surgery? And he goes, yeah, I'd love to get laser surgery because I'd love to see without wearing glasses. Yeah. It's just, on any given day, do I want to go and sit in a clinic and have a laser pointed into my eye? No thanks, not today.
Yeah, I heard the same interview. Perfect example. Because it is that, isn't it? Well, just today. And you break all of this down into very small parts, which I like to do in the book. And it's the same. It's like, I'm trying to lose weight. I want a six pack. I want to get ready for the summer. Do I want this cake right now? Yeah, I really like cakes. And the reality is, when you want to change your life, when you make it better in whatever way, yeah, there's some sacrifices you need to make. Something I've learned massively in the past 12 months, actually, I've talked about this a lot in recent times with people, is I when I grew up, I used to think there was a perfect place to live, a perfect friend, a perfect wife, perfect family, perfect job. And something I've realized is that's not true. And just by sort of accepting that and understanding it, it makes life so much easier, because no matter where you go, I've just been in Bali for 10 weeks. And as soon as you say that to people, like, wow, paradise. Well, there's things about paradise that aren't as good as living in Liverpool. And even practical things like the Wi-Fi is not as good. And it's not until you're in that place that you're like, yeah, actually, do you know, it's really nice having bin men that collect your bins every week.
Paul, can I ask you, in terms of making changes to your life, anyone's life, in terms of worst case scenarios, which you picture in your mind, in terms of those changes, what was the one aspect that came close to the worst case scenario, or are things generally more straightforward when you actually get around to doing? Because you always picture in your mind, oh, well, what if, well, what if? What were the things which were most difficult that maybe came closer to those worst case scenario sort of ideas?
In the sense of actually making the changes?
In terms of actually doing it and going, oh, actually, yeah. Because, of course, you've got to make people redundant or things like that. You know, that they are difficult things to do.
Yeah, the simple answer to that is nothing's as bad as we think it's going to be, generally speaking. And this is something I spend a lot of time going through with people, actually, is we allow our minds are really good at imagining these horrendous situations. And I always talk to people about them being like these big, dark rain clouds above our heads. And when you start picking at the rain clouds and pulling threads away from them just by being specific about them, it's incredible how quickly they fall away. So if you sit down and when you've got these things going around in your mind about the worst case scenario, if you actually sit down with a pen and paper and say, okay, what is the worst case scenario? Write it down. What's your biggest fear in this? Then you can start saying, okay, even if that happens, what do we do? And one of the examples in the book which springs to mind is the family one. So one of my biggest things that keeps me trapped in being a lawyer for so long is what the family think. But I never actually went to speak to the family to say, I'm miserable in this. Do you mind if I just pack it in? And the reality is, as soon as you do that, your family say, of course. We don't want you to be miserable. It's a story I've created in my mind about what I need to do to please my family. Whereas as soon as you sit down and go through it all, of course they're fine with it. And now all they ever say to me is, we just want you to be happy. And it's nice because that creates a new narrative within the family generally, where the other kids coming through now, there's more of a narrative of, we want you to be happy. So don't feel like you've got to do anything for everybody else.
And for want of a better phrase, it empowers them to go, oh, well, he changed his career, so maybe I can do make a change in mine. The first couple of chapters are available for free on the website changeyourcareer.org. That's changeyourcareer.org, so people can read the first couple of chapters for themselves. And then where can people pick up a copy of the book?
So it's on Amazon. Just search. Well, you can get to it via the website or just go straight to Amazon and search The Seven Secrets to Change Your Career.
The Seven Secrets to Change Your Career, the author, Paul Cope, and our guest this week on Mental Health Monday. Paul, thank you for your time.
My pleasure.
Thanks for joining us. What's your official career status now, or do you less define yourself by your career as to define yourself by things now?
Yeah, that's a long answer. And interestingly, actually, one of the things going back to what you said right at the start, I think it's fascinating. We live in a world where that's the first thing we ask each other. What do you do? Not what makes you happy. What we mean is, how do you make money? Which is, I mean, a really sad thing to make. I would say going forward, I'm going to be an author. When I have to answer that question.
Paul, thank you for your time. Absolute pleasure. The book is available now on Amazon. You can get a couple of free chapters of it as well. Changeyourcareer.org.
Mental Health Monday with Mick Coyle.
Radio City Talk.